wonderful opportunity to be here today with high school students watching our conferences. And in the opinion this court renders in this case, you're not only going to be telling lawyers and law students about what the rules of discovery really mean, but the future lawyers sitting in that audience are going to receive a message from this case as to whether or not a party in litigation does not produce photographs of an accident, signs interrogatory answers under oath swearing that they've all been produced, receives information 30 days before trial that all the photographs have not been produced, and then not until after a verdict, for the first time are those photographs produced to the opposing side. And to understand the harm that those pictures cause, the damage that we sustain by our inability to have those photographs, requires an understanding of how those photographs came about. Set of photographs we never saw were done on the day of the accident. Those were the most current pictures depicting the conditions that were available.
Weren't they recreations of the conditions?
They were recreations of the conditions. And when those photographs went to Andy Callahan, the car foreman, he saw those pictures on his computer. And he made the decision then that we want a second set of photographs. And then it was 2 days later they went out and shot a different set of photographs. And those were the only photographs that Mr. Callahan forwarded to the claim agent, and the only ones produced in discovery. And what was particularly troubling is at the same time those photographs were being introduced at trial, Mr. Callahan was their corporate representative sitting there at trial listening to the testimony.
So didn't the trial court find that the failure to disclose was not intentional, and that even the railroad had used reasonable diligence to find those pictures?
I don't believe they said they had used reasonable diligence.
Didn't the court say that you couldn't have found them with reasonable diligence because the other side had exercised reasonable diligence and hadn't found them?
But they were aware, their corporate representative was aware that those photographs existed. And the attorney for BNSF was told 30 days before trial by the witness whose credibility was crucial to the case, when he looks at the photograph, says, I don't think those are all the photographs. Mr. Herrera was aware of what he was looking at. But yet, when you look at his testimony at trial, remember, Mr. Herrera is the one who hits the pallet of water. Mr. Herrera's testimony about how fast he's going, his ability to remember, perceive, all of those are crucial questions for this jury. And Mr. Herrera told a claim agent after this accident, within 60 days, he says, I hit that table with a pallet of water bottles. Yet, when he gets to trial, Mr. Herrera, when he takes the stand, says, no, the pallet of water never struck the table. How do you know that? Because I looked at the pictures. And the pictures he was being shown by their lawyer were the pictures that were taken in the second reenactment and not the first reenactment.
Was it based on the location of the pallet to the table, or was it based on the direction in which the pallet and the table were in respect to each other?
At the hearing of post-trial, Mr. Herrera testified it was based on the location, or in other words, the direction of the pallet of water to the table. However, if you look at the photographs, what we received in discovery, the stage photographs, the second reenactment, shows the pallet over here and the table here. When we received the first set of photographs after the trial, for the first time we see pictures that show the pallet of water into the table. And instead of the front of the sweeper striking it, which has a low profile and what the jury saw, instead it was the large rear end of the sweeper that struck it. And I think what we go back to, Judge, in your question concerning intent, you know, the Alloy case is important here because it dealt with, in that case, the loss of evidence by a party in litigation, in that case, the UP that had lost inspection records on a locomotive. And one of the questions the court had to grapple with there is whether or not intent should be a factor in determining whether or not a sanctions instruction is given to the jury or an adverse inference instruction. And what the court said there is it doesn't matter what the intent is. The effect of it is to deprive the parties of the ability, or the party of the ability to have the evidence. And I think in this case, to say that we have to show that the result would have probably changed, I think the evidence based on the difference in the picture, shows that. But more importantly, I think the court is permitted to infer from the fact these photographs were not produced.
Well, Mr. Kvas, would the outcome be different as to negligence or to causation?
It'd be different as to negligence for this reason, because in this case, the way the railroad presented Mr. Herrera's testimony and what Mr. Herrera testified to was that he was going at 1 to 2 miles an hour. It was barely a tap. But he testified that he couldn't even tell whether or not he had struck something. He just thought the sweeper stopped of its own volition. Seeing the original set of photographs, which we never saw, would cast serious doubt as to whether or not he could have been traveling at 1 to 2 miles per hour.
Well,
because of the distance of the pallet of water.
Counsel, but those second photographs weren't photographs taken of the scene immediately after the incident. Those were restaged photographs. So in other words, they don't necessarily depict what the scene was any more than the second set of photographs necessarily depicted what the scene was at the time of the incident.
Well, what we see, though, are two very different sets of photographs. The photographs that we did receive were photographs that were taken that same day of the accident. And that pallet is loaded with water bottles.
Well,
for the second set of photographs, we see almost all of the water bottles removed and a lunchbox and a notepad placed on top of it to make it look as if there wasn't enough movement to even move the lunchbox or the notepad.
What was the evidence, though, as to the lunchbox and the notepad? I thought the evidence was that those weren't placed there by the railroad in recreating the scene. Those were already there because they had been placed there by other employees.
They just happened to be there when they decided to take those photographs after Mr. Callahan had reviewed the first set and decided they needed a second set of photographs. And we didn't have that. That wasn't even something we were able to argue at the time of trial, because we didn't even know the existence of those photographs until after this trial.
I want to ask you about the Alloy case and your contention that we should apply that analysis here. It seems like you're asking us to really make a very big change in the law applicable to newly discovered evidence by importing the law applicable to destroyed evidence. And where do we draw the line there? Because after all, newly discovered evidence is often going to come from your opponent. And it seems like what you're saying is when it comes from your opponent, you should be able to draw an adverse inference.
Oh, I disagree. I mean, newly discovered evidence, I think as it's contemplated by the rule, is evidence to which neither party had access at the time of an accident, an unknown document, an unknown witness to both sides. Completely different than the case where someone has the evidence in their possession.
Did you cite us any authority for that proposition? The newly discovered evidence presumes that neither side had access to the evidence. In your briefs, did you cite us any authority for that? Okay.
But I think there has to be a distinction this court draws, because you're going to render license to lawyers practicing. If you can get away with this, if we can do a second reenactment photos, and we can ditch the first ones, and we can sign interrogatory answers saying we've produced everything, then it's license for the lawyers to say, let's take a shot at it. What's the worst that happens? And that's why I think the presumption has to, particularly when there are photographs dealing with a reenactment that's done the day of an accident, that there is harm caused by that failure to disclose.
Well, but didn't the court here make a finding that counsel wasn't at fault for this? I mean, it seems to me you're saying counsel hid these photographs, and the trial court made an express finding that counsel didn't know about them and yet tried to find them and couldn't.
Well, 2 points on that. One, the evidence was that counsel was aware of it 30 days before trial when Mr. Herrera testifies that he spoke with the attorney about them. Secondly, with respect to the photographs, What, regardless of what counsel knew or didn't know, the BNSF surely knew it, because it was their general car foreman whose jurisdiction this accident fell under, who had the photographs and failed to turn them over. And I don't know that you can draw a distinction between the actions of the lawyer or the actions of the party they both caused to combine the same harm. Let me just, if I could.
What do we do with the trial court's findings about reasonable diligence and unintentional? Do we just disregard those? Are they overcome somehow by other evidence?
I think you can find that, even if you were to find that counsel acted with reasonable diligence, you can't find that BNSF did. BNSF representatives had to sign those interrogatories.
I don't think the court distinguished between counsel and BNSF. I think they said the other party was reasonably diligent.
And I don't know how that can be reconciled with the testimony. If I could just briefly touch on our JNOV argument. The railroad's claim was, or tactic at trial, was to attempt to divorce the negligence of BNSF from that of its employee. In other words, they tried to create a schism. They did it by doing it this way. They said, we're a reasonably safe railroad. We have reasonably safe rules. We have reasonably safe equipment. We train our employees. And then at the same time, attempt to divorce themselves from Herrera's conduct. And that can't be done. When Herrera says he misjudges the distance, that is the definition of negligence. If it isn't, what if we have the case involving a collision of two locomotive engines? And the dispatcher is called to the witness stand to say, I misjudged the position of the switch. The train shouldn't have been on the right track. I was reasonably safe the day before. I was reasonably safe up to that moment. I just misjudged the position of the switch. As excusing that act, it doesn't. For the purposes of JNOV, where someone like Mr. Whipple is sitting at a table, is not an active participant in any way. He isn't darting out from behind an object. There's no mechanical problem with the sweeper. Herrera testifies there's nothing to obstruct his vision. The only conclusion that can be drawn is that that conduct is negligence as a matter of law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Daly, you were absolutely correct. The trial judge did determine that due diligence was performed by not only myself, but my co-counsel, as well as my client. There was a very simple explanation for what had happened. We presented that to the court. I do believe that District Judge Shelley Gilman did everything that she folks would have expected her to do in this case. The matter was fully briefed. We submitted affidavits in connection with the briefing. She opted to hold an evidentiary hearing. She did not simply rule from the briefs and the affidavits. We essentially went in for a full-blown trial in one whole day. Witnesses were produced, exhibits were offered, and closing arguments were made. There were four issues that she took a look at. One was whether or not the photographs actually existed. Photographs that served as the premise for motion in limine did not exist. They contended that there were photographs showing marks on the floor, skid marks on the floor. There were no such photographs as that. They contended that there were boxes with the photographic boxes all over the floor, and there were no such photographs.
But there were photographs depicting the sweeper closer in proximity to the table.
Yes. Week before, the day after the accident, 2 weeks after it. The reenactment was done based upon partial information that Mr. Stepka had received from Mr. Herrera. He then talked with Mr. Whipple and Mr. Whipple's friends and buddies and Carmen, who were fellow union members. He then went back and attempted to do a reenactment again. On each occasion, he would move the table over to where the pallet was. These were simply stages or staged photographs that could have been done at any point in time. There was no proof in this case that the second set of photographs had any more validity than the first set or vice versa. However, you need to understand that had they used the first photographs, it would have impeached their own witnesses because it showed something different. It showed what Mr. Whipple and his co-workers were attempting to say. Now, that was the judge's ruling that they were not material.
What would they have impeached? On what points would the first set of pictures have impeached Mr. Whipple's witnesses? On what points?
The sweeper where it was backing up toward the pallet. Mr. Whipple indicated, and his co-workers indicated, that the sweeper was pulling in a forward fashion. So there's no reason that they would have used those photographs in the first place. But the judge also dealt with the, she said she could have denied the motion in its entirety simply because the photographs that they claimed existed didn't. She went on to assess the materiality. She went on to assess the burden and whether it would have probably changed the result. And she concluded that it didn't. What more could you ask from one of your district judges? She held the evidentiary hearing. She analyzed what the credibility of the witnesses were.
Did she misapply the standard of materiality?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not, sure. The standard that she looked at was whether or not these photographs were something akin to a surveillance photo, a surveillance film showing the actual event as compared with a staged photo or a recreation or a reenactment. And it became clear that Mr. Stefka, when he first took the photographs, just simply based his photographs on half of the information. It wasn't done for purposes of this litigation. It was done for purposes of a disciplinary investigation had they ended up going that direction. Now, the counsel basically says the judge got it wrong, and this burden of proof is suddenly changed under the Aloy case, and that it becomes my obligation to show that it wouldn't have changed the results. In other words, they're saying that the Court of Appeals also got this wrong for the last 50, 70, or 100 years. If you take a look at Rule 59 and see the annotations that follow that, the burden has always been on the moving party for the last 100 years to establish that it would have changed the result. The judge didn't even, the district judge didn't have to get to that.
Well, Mr. Bean, that's right. Well, what is your response to that the lack of presentation of those photographs actually influenced the testimony at trial?
I don't believe it did. The testimony was based upon each individual's recollection. Mr. Herrera testified as to what you recall. Mr. Palusa and Mr. Haskell also testified as to what they recall. I don't think those photographs made any difference whatsoever, and that was the district judge's findings, and that has to be set aside on the use of discretion standard, which is a very high standard. And I don't think that we want a court of appeal to step in and simply say, oh, well, she must have gotten it wrong, and she should have looked at this or she should have looked at this. Judge Gilman held an evidentiary hearing, and we brought in the witnesses. We brought in Mr. Stefka. We brought in Mr. Callahan, too, and she analyzed that entire situation. I just don't think that you've gotten it wrong for the last 100 years in terms of this burden. I think it should be affirmed with regard to the motion for the trial. I also wanted to talk briefly.
Counsel. Counsel, can I ask one question? What about the point that was made by your opposing counsel about if you don't adapt this motion for new trial, a newly discovered evidence rule, we will have lawyers sandbagging each other?
I would hope, Your Honor, that we have enough credibility as professionals that does not happen in this particular case. It was raised to me that other photographs might exist. I wanted those photographs as bad as anyone. I wanted to see what they might show and whether they would help me in the defense of the case. I asked Mr. Stefka, and that was in the record, if you would go out and double check to make sure that there aren't any other photos, or if there are, I need to get them produced immediately. Had there been any other photos, we would have turned them over instantaneously, whether the day before the trial, in the middle of the trial, or whatnot. So, brought in Mr. Stefka, Mr. Callahan, to explain exactly what happened. And the trial court determined that due diligence had been exercised on both their part as well as my part, and that she didn't find that there was any intentional withholding of evidence. I don't subscribe to that. I never have, and I would not. I believe that most lawyers would not as well. If you could, just a minute. Counsel is basically saying that the judge got it wrong in terms of that, and if the judge got it wrong, then the jury got it wrong. And the argument is that no reasonable jury, right mind, would ever come up with this conclusion. And I strongly disagree. There was conflicting evidence all the way around. The Safeway case that's cited in the brief makes it clear from the Supreme Court that this is a jury question. I think it's improper that someone would attempt to challenge seven jurors, as well as the judge who ruled on this issue essentially twice, once on the JNOV, once on the motion for new trial. There was ample evidence in the record suggesting that there was a conflict as to what actually occurred on that day.
Mr. Beam, isn't it conceded, though, that Mr. Herrera misjudged the distance?
If he misjudged the distance. He indicated that he had misjudged the distance. However, there is something in the record indicating that he attempted to turn around, and basically, he came very close to the pallet. He wasn't even sure that he had struck the pallet. He said, normally, if you strike something, you will feel a jolt. And his testimony was, I didn't feel a jolt.
So what, was there a dispute, though, really, as to whether he struck the pallet, even though he did claims not to have felt it? I mean, something happened. There's a chain reaction here. So something seems to have struck the pallet.
Well, it was a very convoluted case, Your Honor. That he may have struck the pallet. I'm telling you that there was some evidence for which the jury could conclude that he didn't strike the pallet. Credibility came into question, and then there was a huge conflict as to whether or not the pallet slid enough to even touch the table. So, number one, there was a dispute as to whether he struck the pallet. There was a bigger dispute as to whether the pallet struck the table. That's where the jury goes in to weigh the evidence and weigh the credibility of all of these witnesses. So you have someone who's attempting to turn around, and I don't think you can say that simply turning around constitutes negligence as a matter of law. I do it with a lawnmower. I do it with a vacuum cleaner. When I'm at home vacuuming.
Well, let me suggest this. Three witnesses, Whipple and his two friends, said the pallet struck the table.
Yes.
Herrera at trial said it didn't, but in his pretrial deposition it said it did. Would a reasonable jury conclude that it didn't based on that evidence?
I think that's why we have jurors to determine to make those assessments. Okay? The deposition, they don't have an opportunity to actually see the witness testify. Okay? They don't have an opportunity to see what the mannerisms are. For example, if someone said to me, how did the oral argument go? On the record, it may go, well, I thought it went just fine. Okay? On the record, it's going to say it went just fine. Mannerisms might suggest something entirely different. That's why we put the discretion into the jurors. We have seven jurors. The judge could have rehearsed it and chose not to. She also had an opportunity.
So are you basing your entire position on simply the evidence that it never struck the table? Or do you have an alternative argument that even if it did strike the table, there was still enough debate about whether it was negligence? If so, what would that argument be?
My argument would be that this falls within the province of the jury. All of the case law suggests that it does. My position is...
What is the evidence to which the jury would consider it debatable?
The evidence is that even under the jury instructions, okay, an accident is not evidence or inference of negligence. That jury instruction is given without any objection. The real issue, Your Honor, is whether or not we provided a safe place to work. And this is based on federal law. This is not based on state law. The duty under the federal law is to provide a reasonably safe place to work. So what do? I ask my witnesses, several witnesses, did you attempt to provide a safe place to work? The answer was yes. There is evidence in the record from Mr. Crilly, Mr. Callahan, Mr. Herrera, whether they provided a safe place to work. The thrust of their case was to say, hey, you violated one of your own safety rules. A safety rule then becomes get bootstrapped up to a failure to provide a reasonably safe place to work. There was ample evidence that there was a reasonably safe place to work. That was instruction number 13. The allegation was that the defendant failed to provide the plaintiff with a reasonably safe place to work.
Mr. Beam, Let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say that I'm following the car in front of me, and I'm following too close. The car in front of me stops. I have misjudged how long it will take me to stop. Even though I slam on the brakes relatively instantly, I rear in the car in front of me. Now, in that case, all I've done is misjudge the distance, but I think it's pretty well settled. I'd be negligent in that case. So it seems like in certain circumstances, misjudging the distance is negligence. And here we're talking about somebody driving a vehicle. So what's the difference? No, you have to have injury. You have to have injury to have negligence. So here we have an injury. I mean, that's the big difference.
Counsel. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Your time has expired. Thank you for your argument, counsel. Go ahead, counsel.
I told him I thought I'd hit the table, but after I reviewed some of those pictures we took, I don't think that pallet even touched the table. That's based on the second dimension photo. That's how close Mr. Burrow's testimony was shaped. And again, in argument, what you hear is an attempt of the BNSF to say, if the place where we repair locomotives back shop that is a reasonably safe place to work, that somehow maybe we can get an excuse if we have someone who makes a mistake and runs into something with the sweeper. That isn't the case. At that moment in time that Mr. Herrera strikes that pallet of water bottles and it goes into the table, Mr. Herrera is the BNSF. That is the action of the BNSF. And his misjudgment of that is negligence. In the Safeway case, there's a crucial distinction. Safeway case involved a grocery store employee who ran into the back of a woman with a shopping cart as he was bringing it out in the lot. And what the court focused on in that case to say, you know, that was an issue for the jury. The reason they did that is because there was testimony that the woman, while walking out of the store, stopped and turned to glance at a display. And that her sudden stop was not necessarily something that the employee of the store could or should have anticipated. And it was based on that, a decision was made that that was then a case for the jury. That's very different from this case, where Mr. Whipple isn't moving at all, and he is seated at the table.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Wasn't there evidence from which a jury could at least debate whether or not there was a duty of care owed to Mr. Whipple as he sat at the table, because that table was not located in the normal break area, and the workers were supposed to be on break?
No. The duty of care extends to an employee, no matter where they are. Even if they're sent onto the property of another employer, the railroad's obligation to provide a reasonably safe place to work extends there.
It does, but isn't there some question about reasonable foreseeability and the foreseeability of the accident that would cause jury questions?
No, not in this instance. What they tried to argue for foreseeability is because this had not happened before. that this was an unusual accident that wasn't foreseeable. That isn't the test of foreseeability under the FVLA. I mean, we're going back to Gallagher against Baltimore in Ohio, where the railroad was held liable for an incident that came onto railroad property, bit a man's leg, ultimately resulting in its amputation. In that case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that is an injury that is foreseeable. The fact that some harm could be foreseen is sufficient. And in fact, I asked Mr. Herrera the question, could you foresee that if you hit the pallet or bottles into the table, could you foresee that someone could get hurt? And his response to that question is yes.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your argument. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And the bailiff will announce a short recess.